Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
You wrestle with doubts. You wish you had answers to questions like, how come I don't feel spiritual? Do you ever ask yourself, is there really any such thing as a victorious Christian life? And if so, why can't I seem to find it? Well, here's your chance to hear from one of the best what the Reformation faith has to say to these longings. And we'll tell you more about it in just a moment. But first, tonight's Walking with God topic, the Christian and work. Are you just working for the weekend? Do you sometimes feel as though you're just a cog in a machine, punching a clock until the weekend rolls around again? Many of us have been taught that there are two levels of Christian commitment. Those who are really sold out for the Lord and are what's called full-time Christian ministry, while the rest of us settle for a secular job. This is the very problem which our Protestant reformers saw in medieval Christianity. There were two levels. The monasteries were like today's Christian organizations, employing huge staffs of low-paid spiritual types who didn't like being out in the world too much. These were called the religious. Then there were the seculars, that is, those Christians who were content to have a normal job fixing watches or building houses for folks in town. The reformers argued that this was a denial of the biblical doctrine known as the priesthood of all believers. Luther said that a milkmaid who milked her cow to the glory of God was more spiritual than a nun. Calvin concurred. As a result, the Protestant work ethic was born. Those who followed the Reformation course were soon distinguished by their dedication to and enjoyment of their work. Finally, they found dignity and spiritual value in even the most mundane of activities. Well, once again today, many Christians are known not by the quality of their work, but by the separation of believers into the spiritual folks who are forced to enter the evangelical monastery if they want to be engaged in really meaningful, God-honoring activity. Oh, great artists, filmmakers, writers, and thinkers, if they want to leave a mark on the world, are often forced to endure the stares of their brothers and sisters who think they've sold out for fame and fortune. I heard a story recently about a man who had incredible talents as a painter. He came from a deeply devout Christian background, and he knew he had the skill and interest in becoming a good artist, but his friends in church warned him against getting too sidetracked from what really mattered, evangelism and the church. So he ended up painting baptistries and designing church bulletins for the rest of his life, dying an old, disappointed, and misled artist, his talents completely squandered. Is this typical, do you think, of some very tragic lives today?
Yeah, I think it's very typical. I think that's one very good illustration of this whole problem that has pervaded evangelicalism, and that's the loss of this doctrine, the priesthood of all believers, the doctrine of calling.
What is that doctrine?
Well, it originated, I think, with Luther, and the background you've already given. Basically, what he said was that since the incarnation...
Wait, what do you mean by incarnation?
That God became a man once, okay, when Quirinius was governor of Syria.
Okay, Christmas. And,
yep, all right. Like that. That the fact that God had become flesh in the person of Jesus Christ hallowed all work, so that the two-tier thing you described in medieval thought was actually opposed to what the reformers were saying, and they thought they were much more on a biblical track. Luther used to illustrate by saying, you mentioned the milkmaid. Another one that he used was to say that the bootmaker would make a good quality boot and sell it at a fair price, and that was his ministry.
Ooh, that was his ministry.
Yep.
So he didn't have to evangelize everybody on the job. Making a good boot was,
yes,
was his spiritual service.
Yes.
That was his calling.
Well, where do we go to the scriptures to find this kind of a concept?
Well, you start with the doctrine of God, because the scriptures reveal a God who is a working God, a creating God, a God who's known by what he does in addition to what he says. And I think Rod points out the next step that goes to the incarnation. Jesus didn't come to earth as a missionary. He came to earth as a carpenter. He was not born into an evangelical family that sent him to Christian college. He was born into a family of woodworkers.
Yeah.
And he made cabinets and he made chairs. And There would have been pieces of furniture in first century Palestine that you could have seen that Jesus actually built.
And he didn't. They weren't distinguished by having
he
fishes
didn't carve
on them,
fish or cross or anything else on them. No,
just did good work.
He made did good work.
Yeah, I've often wondered that. Gosh, were those 30 years wasted? Those 30 years of our Lord being on earth. I mean, God comes to earth, and Jesus only spends 33 years on this earth with us, and he spends 30 of those 33 years doing menial labor. My goodness. I mean,
well, I think that's the whole point, is I don't think we would consider it menial labor. We would consider it hand labor as opposed to menial.
Dr. Oz Guinness has been addressing us in the last couple of shows, and we have one more clip from him tonight. Oz Guinness, of course, has been in charge of the Williamsburg Charter and also a fellow of the Brookings Institution.
I think a notion like calling delivers us from these pitfalls, because the first thing is we don't just follow the crowds. We're not mobilized nationally. Each of us has our own gifts, our own callings, our own walk before the Lord. And we're not called to clear up Sacramento or Washington or wherever the state capital is necessarily if that's not within the sphere of our calling.
Mm.
And it's ordinary people being faithful everywhere they go. Then the salt and light will be really penetrating throughout society.
What is that?
In other words, the problem in America is not that Christians aren't where they should be, so let's all get into politics or whatever. The problem is they're not what they should be right where they are.
Number is 1-800-331-KKLA. Get in line to talk to us. We'll be opening up the lines in just a moment. 1-800-331-KKLA. We want to tell you, too, about the conference, since this is the last night we'll be able to do so. The first 2 days of March, Dr. McGrath, and we've told you a lot about this conference in the past, will be dealing with all Friday night and all day Saturday questions like, why don't I feel closer to God? How do I handle doubt? Why doesn't my job have more meaning? The very subjects we've been talking about. What is real godliness? I want to be holy. I want to live a godly life. And yet I'm sick of jumping through all these hoops. What is a biblical vision for life? And if you call us during office hours beginning tomorrow at 714-956-CURE, we'll put you on a list that makes sure you get in on the pre-registration rather than the at-the-door price. But you have to call this week in order to get that. It's only $25 for the entire conference, both Friday night and all day Saturday at the First Presbyterian Church of Hollywood. Once again, the number 714-956-CURE. Taking off on what Oz said, when we were talking about the origin and character of this Protestant work ethic, this isn't just something that the Reformers made up and is kind of obscure. Non-Christian sociologists and historians and economists...
Max Weber, for one.
Yeah, they refer to the Protestant work ethic all the time.
Yeah, it's it finds its way into the practical sphere in the frustration of working on the Detroit car lines. And for a while... I've heard that Volvo put together teams that would construct a car, and that team would stick together. Hmm. And just in doing that and having the camaraderie that comes with having that team, they built a better car.
Hmm. Calvin said every individual's calling and way of life, therefore, is like a post assigned to him by the Lord himself, so that he will not spend his whole life wandering about in uncertainty. There are a lot of us wandering around in uncertainty because we don't really have a sense that God has given us a post, a place to stand.
But Mike, you'd put the whole evangelical seminar business out of work because people aren't taught to find satisfaction through their labors. They're frustrated because God has created man to work. When man is told by his church that work is somehow secondary to his spiritual life, he chops himself in half psychologically. His work then frustrates him. He feels guilty because he has to do something that's not spiritual. He's got to do that to eat, and then that makes him neurotic. So now he has to pay to go to a spiritual seminar or to some spiritual practice so that he can kind of try and put himself back together again.
Was work something instituted in creation?
Yeah, it's part of the creation order.
It wasn't an aspect of of the curse then, of the
no,
fall.
No, it's not. The aspect of the curse is the sweat on our brow, not work itself.
That we lose a lot of the enjoyment.
The frustration, the fact that we can spend a day working in our garden and to produce a beautiful garden as Adam did, we have the problem of finding in 2 weeks that garden is full of thorns and weeds again.
Mm. I think of the day in which we live where there's a sense of rootlessness, where there's a lot of mobility, social mobility, and people move from one job to another. Bousma, professor at UC Berkeley, said this about the Reformation's idea of the work ethic. It was deeply reassuring, he says, in a time of increasing social mobility. Well, that sounds like us. For peasants who had moved into towns, young men whose occupations differed from those of their fathers, exiles, all overwhelmed by a sense of being caught up in an arbitrariness, absurdity, rootlessness, and danger, to know that God himself had assigned these new roles. That really, that could make the same difference in people's lives today, couldn't it?
It really could, and it should again.
A sense of having those roots. Now, Calvin often spoke of life as a drama. Shakespeare sort of takes that from that way of thinking when he says all of life is a stage and we are all actors. Our calling really is our character in that play, isn't it?
Sure it is.
Yeah, it's there's not a doubt about it. And one of the ways we can find our way out of this thicket, ironic as it sounds, is to look back 400 years to find our way about now.
Mm. Our number's 1-800-331-KKLA. Maybe you are one of those struggling artists or a musician or someone who has a lot of talents in business or in...
Or a homemaker who feels guilty because she's at home with her kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Give us a call at 1-800-331-KKLA. We want to talk about this with you today. Christ himself told his disciples that he would care for them in their calling, as he cares for the flowers of the field. So calling ends anxiety, but it also ends ambition because all callings are equal in the face of God, life lived in the face of God.
There's one interesting vignette in Lewis's The Great Divorce, where at one point the general picture of the book is that it's a bus ride from hell to the gate of heaven, and their friends from heaven come out and invite them in again. Lewis was using it as a literary device, not believing that there was a second chance, but showing that people were in hell because they chose to be there. At one point, the action breaks, and a woman comes riding by on a steed, and the fellow from hell said, "Who was that?" And his friend from heaven said, "Well, you wouldn't know her. Her name was such and such, and she was a washerwoman in East London. She's one of the great ones here."
Wow. Amazing. I think that's the way it'll be. We'll learn that some of the people who made the greatest impact were not on our front pages of our church history books.
Yeah, Lewis portrayed all of his heroes as those who were emptying waste baskets or blue collar.
Mm.
And he was onto it, though I don't know if he'd read Luther on Vocation. That was the root of that.
One of the great Reformation poets, George Herbert, said, "He who sweeps the floor, you know, to the glory of God." John Milton, the great poet, said, "As ever in my taskmaster's eye."
Well, just think of our local churches. The guy that shows up an hour early and does all the cleanup and empties the trash and, you know, restocks all the supplies and makes the coffee, he's great in the kingdom of God.
Calvin wrote, "It is a singular consolation to know that no task is so sordid and base, provided you acknowledge that it is your calling and are convinced it will thus shine and be reckoned very precious in God's sight." That reminds me of a story I once heard. John Stott tells this, that there was a quarry and people were hewing stone. And an individual walked by and said, "What are you doing?" And a worker who happened to be working nearby said, "Well, we're hewing stones out of the quarry." And then finally he came up to this one individual and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm building a cathedral." Now, they were both performing the same function, but for one person, he couldn't see beyond the fact that he was just chipping away at a bit of stone. The other person said, "I'm building a cathedral." That really is the difference between a job and a calling for a Christian, isn't it?
It really is.
And don't you think that for many of us, the real worry is that you'll get to be 55, 65, 75 years old, and maybe the fact that you didn't do something that you felt you ought, that what you did do will get lost in the shuffle. And the biblical message is, it never will.
Mm.
It is never lost in the shuffle.
Colossians 3:23, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord. It is the Lord Christ you are serving." Does that mean that it is the Lord Christ I am serving, even when I'm not witnessing on the job, even when I'm just doing the job well?
Yeah, I think it would be entirely appropriate for an aeronautical engineer, if asked, "What is your ministry?" to say, "I design a good airfoil so that people can land at San Francisco International safely. That's my ministry."
It'd be nice to get back to that point again. I think before we take our break here, the Paul's comments to the Thessalonians we talked about 2 weeks ago, And Paul wrote them, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders and so that you will not be dependent on anybody. The idea that earn your own way and that your work should be of such a sufficient quality that people will say, what is it about you? Why does your work make sense and mine doesn't?
Yes.
I'm reminded of the wisdom of Solomon. The sleep of a laborer is sweet. It is good and proper for a man to eat and drink and to find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days God has given him. Moreover, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. He seldom reflects on the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with gladness of heart. Todd in Los Angeles, good evening.
Good evening, how are you?
Fine.
When you were speaking about, well, actually, the comment is this. I am submissive to my boss. Scripture reminds me to do this. But I do it to the glory of God in my job. I do. Seeing since the boss is a wet noodle, be kindly.
Know the type.
yeah, it happens. Therefore, I have to go in, and with the manic Monday song that you just played, tomorrow, open-minded, and joyfully, prayerfully, spiritually, hoping that the light of Christ shines through me, that maybe, just maybe, he'll pick up on it. But so I get through like that.
What do you think his response is to your performance on the job? I mean, that's kind of a personal question, but do you think that is the centerpiece, really, of your witness, even before you're able to?
I think so. I really do. The performance and my performance of reviews have been excellent. He feels perhaps I am a religious man. Well, I'm not a religious man. I'm a faithful man. I think quite often he's confused on that.
Mm-hmm.
When I come in, while the crucifix is around my neck.
Yeah. Well, what do you guys think about? How would you respond to?
Well, it's the sort of thing that can go from being relatively satisfactory to pretty miserable. One of the questions we haven't touched on yet is, what about if I'm pretty sure I'm in the wrong place?
Mm.
And we haven't really gotten into that.
Well, quite often in large business, and unfortunately, the company that I'm with is not a Christian. They're not Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not. It tells me, well, maybe I should get out. Because quite often I feel suffocated.
Yeah, not necessarily. Here you're
really taking it out on him. I should really take a look and say, Lord, is this really where you want me?
Yeah, the pagan will always behave as a pagan, but that's not to say that all pagans behave the same way. It is, here you're operating at the level of reason. And if you're doing an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, the question then is this really where I want to work? But you might like to switch to working for another pagan.
Yeah, the other question I would ask is, are you doing what you want to be doing?
Right.
You know, one of the things when you work your way up through the seminary system, you know, you're always having on Wednesday the missions conference, and the missionary speakers come in. They always tell you that, gee, it's God's will really for you to be a missionary in Africa. Well, I know that God's will for me is not to be a missionary in Africa because there's certain things in my life I want to do. One of them is teach. I want to teach, so I know that that's what God's will is for my life, because God's not going to trick me by giving me a desire to teach and then sending me to Africa to be a missionary against what he's built in me that I enjoy doing. And that's the kind of question you have to ask yourself. Are you doing what you like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, doesn't it mess us up when we get into the whole knowing God's will for my life?
Well, it's the same thing you mentioned earlier. Yeah. You get into this two-tiered business that's right out of medievalism.
Sure, yeah.
And you feel guilty for doing something that you might enjoy, woodworking or working with your hands, and you're really good at it, but you have this grinding guilt in the background that really you're doing a less than spiritual thing.
And what's even worse is when you go to your church on the Lord's Day, you find people at the church putting subtle pressure on you. Gee, you know, if you were really spiritual, you know, that plumbing business over there, that's not really as important as having a ministry. You know, you need to quit doing that, or need to spend less time doing that and find something more ministry-oriented.
Well,
that's killing people.
How can a mundane job serve to glorify God? Shouldn't I invest my few years on earth in trying to get the gospel out, even if I do have to work in a secular job? Isn't that just so I can have enough money and time left over to serve the church?
I'll tell one vignette again from Luther. He was asked, what if the Lord were to return tomorrow and you knew it? He said, if I knew that, I think I'd plant a tree.
Well, didn't Jesus say, work until I come?
Yeah.
Occupy until I come. Luther also said this, to serve God simply means to do what God has commanded and not do what God has forbidden. And if only we would accustom ourselves properly to this view, the entire world would be full of service to God. Not only the churches, but also the home, the kitchen, the cellar, the workshop, and the field of townsfolk and farmers. A poor maid, he said, should have the joy in her heart of being able to say, now, I'm cooking, making the bed, sweeping the house. Who's commanded these things? My master and my mistress have. Who has given them authority over me? God has. Very well, then, it must be true that I'm serving not them alone, but also God in heaven, and that God must be pleased with my service. How could I possibly be more blessed? Why, my service is like cooking for God in heaven. In this way, he said, a man could be happy and of good cheer in all his trouble and labor. But the devil operates in order to make sure that people do not love their work and that no service be rendered to God. Eric in Azusa, good evening.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's a long time coming, sometimes finding the true conviction of what God wants you to do, particularly when you keep, quote-unquote, bumping heads with churchmen, you know?
Yes, it makes it extra difficult.
You, and I've had more bank shots, you know, off of churches going in, wanting to get involved with music arranging and so forth. Well, I went to prayer on the matter and just put it on the shelf and kept praying about it, and I kept getting... I kept getting a Monrovia in my head all the time, see? And somebody that had heard me perform in a restaurant as a musician had suggested I play for his granddaughter's infant baptism at the church. I said, well, what do you want me to play? You haven't heard me play any Christian music down in the restaurant, you know. I'm sure you don't want to hear Stardust in there, you know.
Depends on what kind of church it is, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the guy. I went to a Presbyterian, and he went something else. So I didn't even know what his church was at on doctrinally. I just, okay, so what do you want to hear, mister? You know,
a little Blue Moon, maybe?
But, you know, I found it was really funny because I kept getting a Monrovia in answer to prayer, and this church happened to be in Monrovia, and they invited me, and I prayed for the granddaughter's infant baptism. And I just felt like I was sort of tricked into the answer. Now, I had been wanting to arrange. Now, arranging music, mind you, kind of involves, if you're going to play it live, you're going to have instrumentalists of all kinds. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a luxury you can't afford unless you're in a community band or in a church big enough that has it.
Right.
I spied a cassette deck, and I have my own little home studio, so I wrote arrangements and brought them in there, and the pastor was very nice, and he let me bring it right on in, And I've been a year now. I've got a whole 1 year album I've been doing. We didn't get 1 cent for any of it, but it's brought more peace and more conviction and more improvement in my writing and in my. And I still play, you know, the guitar.
Great.
At the same dinner house where the guy invited me, but
great.
I don't feel like anybody left me behind. I feel like God finally threw the switch on for me.
Well, congratulations.
Quit trying to bump heads with churchmen and just say, God, where do you want me? And listen up.
Sometimes you have to do that. Thanks for the call, Eric. It reminds me of a hotel in Heidelberg where I think I've told this story before. There is on top of the tavern and hotel this big 17th century restored golden leaf, Soli Deo Glory, to God alone be glory. The sense that God's glory invades all of life. Jesus Christ invaded all of life. And here again we have the workplace is not something that it should be alien to a Christian.
It's the place where we should excel.
Yeah, you don't have to work for a Christian. You don't have to, the whole thing of secular and sacred, you know, secular music and sacred
music.
Well,
let me get real ornery and say if you want to have a real job and earn a fair living, then you better not work in a Christian ministry. You better get a real job.
Cheryl in Orange, good evening. What do you think about all this?
Oh, hello. I don't mean to shift gears here, but I have a different question than what you're talking about. I'm a financial analyst, and I'm a newlywed, and I've worked very hard at my job for the last 3 years. It's my first job out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And my question relates to suddenly I'm starting to feel my interests to be torn, because in my professional field, you're expected to work many hours, maybe 8 or 10 hours a day minimum, just to be successful and to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm finding the interests are torn because how do I maintain my Christian life? And now that I have a husband and everything, how do I maintain that at the same time as this job? And I'm losing interest in my job, and I'm starting to resent it, and it's really difficult.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what the Bible has to say about that. I know most people think that the woman's place is in the home, and that's what the Bible says, but I'm not sure it specifically says that.
No, thanks for the call, Cheryl. Yeah, I think what I would say, first of all, is that the family comes first, but it comes first for the husband every bit as much as for the wife. And I don't think any one of us would say that the woman's place is in the home unless that is where she chooses to be.
Sure, that's up to the woman to determine whether her calling is to work full-time or to raise her kids full-time.
The thing is, it's a vocation. It's a godly and noble vocation, just like any other vocation.
Even in a Reformation view, you're going to have 1,000 places where there's friction against the edges as a result of the fall.
Fall is the problem.
And you're going to end up in places where you say, I haven't, no matter how I budget my time, this is not going to come out right. But the deeper thing still has to be a part of the equation. That is, God is pleased with a, quote, secular calling.
Yes, he is. Well, that solution to your problem, Cheryl, is basically common sense. You have to weigh out the pros and the cons of how you want to see your family raised, how much time you want to spend where. And that's one of the real problems with the whole technological age in which we live, is there's a sense in which this idea of work has been corrupted, in that the workplace becomes a tyranny, and that it becomes so stressful and so demanding with all the technological stuff, sitting at a CRT all the time looking at little yellow and green digits. That's one of the places where you really have to struggle to find a balance, and there really is no biblical answer for that other than for you to weigh your priorities.
Sometimes we wonder, what does my work 8 hours a day have to do with God? What is shuffling paper and working for some non-Christian organization or business, what does that really have to do with God? We're reinforced by this in our churches. Even in the college I went to, it was an evangelical college, we had Christian services. It was Christian service assignments, CSs. And what we did was we had to spend a certain number of hours per week working for a church or for a missionary organization, and this was to inculcate in us, hopefully, the sense that we not only had to get our degree and pursue a job so we could make money to give to the church, but we also had to spend time working for a church-related organization, that our work wasn't really enough. I remember people telling stories of coming home tired, having to work for a Christian organization to fill their time, even though they're tired at the end of an 8-hour day, just because they think that's what they're supposed to do. Isn't that a tyranny?
It is a tyranny. And I think that's one of the real problems with education like that, because educational models in situations and institutions like that are founded not on a university schema, but they take their educational model, unfortunately, from the monastic movement.
Mm.
The idea that education is not a university where theology provides the uni in the diversity, but they take their model from this monastic business, that a Christian college is to inculcate you from the world.
Mm. If you have a Christian filmmaker, should he work for Billy Graham's Worldwide Pictures or Paramount? I mean, there are a lot of talented men and women out there who are at that crossroads.
Well, I don't think there's a canned answer to that.
Let's say, is there something unbiblical about choosing a major secular filmmaking agency or a record company?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all.
I'll tell you where we get confused on this. I'm convinced. I think the place we get confused on this is we're expecting a Christian view of sanctification to be a part of every level of Paramount Studios, or somehow we're guilty being a part of it.
Mm.
Now, they could be, or take Disney. You could be doing something that portrays what Tolkien talked about as deep myth, he and Lewis. But as a Christian, sometimes your Christian friends would have you not go there because there's something about it that doesn't put forth the full-orbed Christian life. I would encourage anybody to say, look, if you're doing deep myth stuff, if you're doing Snow White and things that are precursors to the Gospel of John, go do that with excellence.
Yeah, shoemakers don't have to make evangelistic boots. Why should filmmakers have to make evangelistic films? Just create great productions.
Any film that describes life as it is and offers a redemptive solution to that in a realistic context is infinitely better than a film that doesn't describe life as it is for the sake of making a point.
Andrew in Pasadena, good evening.
Yeah, my question basically is, I've been lately, especially getting really close to a lot of friends of mine, and the subject of me being a police officer has come up, and it's something that I've really wanted to do my entire life, basically. I'm 20 years old, and I was reborn Christian about, I was reborn like maybe about 2.5 years ago.
Great.
And the thing that I was wondering is, I'm sort of confused because part of me is really, really wants to get into this, and then another part of me is kind of scared that, like, my ego will overtake, you know, my Christianity, basically what I do, and you know, going to church. I'm scared that my ego would come in and, you know, take a lot of my faith out, because it has before.
Mm-hmm. Would it help to see your calling as a post to which God has called you, where you're working for His glory, so it's not your own ambition, but making
reasonable service to Him.
Exactly.
Show you something, if it's, as you've described, something you've always wanted to do.
That's a good indicator.
That's a real good indicator.
Why do you want to? The psalmist says the Lord gives us the desires of our heart.
Yeah.
And that is an honorable calling before God.
You bet it is.
It's been really weird, because the last couple of days, like the gentleman before, I've been praying on a lot, and things have come into my life. You know, God's put people in my life. Like, I went to get my haircut the other day, and all of a sudden, my usual haircutist, he had a priority over me, and I was sent to this other guy, and he was an ex-police officer.
Mm.
And me and him just sat the entire time and talked about it.
Wow.
He gave me a lot of information about it.
Well, I think our only suggestion would be Paul's: whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord.
Yeah, go for it and do it to the glory of God.
You bet.
I will.
Super, Andrew. Well, thanks a lot for calling.
Hey.
Doug in Venice, good evening.
Yes, sir. This is Doug Burns. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Good.
Listen, I had a question for you, folks.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you mentioning Billy Graham and the worldwide picture market earlier. Now, I'm curious, is there a market that's dealing with pictures such as that are not evangelical, in the sense that they're not, I'm not meaning this in a detrimental sense, but like as in a preaching basis, but more along the lines of a story basis, like a story such as Chariots of Fire or Field of Dreams, along those lines. Is there something in that area that's beginning or that you have knowledge of?
No, but I sure hope so. Anytime I see some of those developing, you're mentioning Field of Dreams, that's got to go down as one of my favorites of the last couple of years.
Me too.
If you take the Anglicans call the via affirmativa, that is, you're not looking for problems in every area of it. The thing is magnificent. But I don't know of somebody who's actually directing their business in that direction. I hope somebody's out there doing it, but I don't know of them.
Now, I wonder why, because it's such a large market, the Christian market is, in that sense. And the opportunity is really, really grand in essence, because there is so many, you know, in the body, and there's such a need actually for it, because, you know, you've got a few good films like Chariots of Fire.
Well, one of the reasons there's such a great need is we're at a sort of a crossroads here, it seems to me. And that is, we're, you know, there's all this New Age monistic philosophical junk out there.
film.
True.
And there's
very religious.
And there's really a place, if somebody will do something with excellence, think of The Exorcist years and years ago in the 70s. That thing stayed to the mark theologically from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And because it was done with excellence and fidelity to a Christian view, it had a tremendous impact.
I think of Ken Curtis, too, who wrote a chapter in our book, The Agony of Deceit, who's the president of Gateway Films.
Gateway.
Yes, and the BBC, the British Broadcasting Company, has him do one film a year for them. And he told me once, he said, you know, A&E approached him, Arts and Entertainment Network, and said, you know, the guy's a Wheaton grad. The guy who's director of programming there, he says, look, I'd love to put on some productions put together by evangelicals.
Okay.
But he says the problem is either they are preachy and not artistic and realistic, or they're just simply not out there. I think we're going to see that changing. I've got a good friend myself who is going into the Hollywood industry.
Mm-hmm.
We have a person at our church who is a director who has had a tremendous impact on training people like Meryl Streep. I think that we're going to see more of that in the future, but to do that, we've got to get out of this nonsense that says that Christians have to write tracks, and if they're going to be filmmakers, they have to produce tracks on film.
I agree 100%.
We've got to get away from that.
Yeah. I understand completely what you're saying. I agree 100%. And do you, in fact, have any options that I might take on this end? Like you said, the individual that's your friend.
Give us a call. I'll tell you what, Doug, give us a call, 714-956-CURE, during office hours, and we'll put you in touch with someone who might be able to help.
Now, that sounds like a winner. Who should I be asking for?
Ask for anyone there. We'll be manning the phones during the week.
Hey, listen, I sincerely appreciate that from the bottom of my heart.
You bet, Doug, and our prayers go with you. It's a very noble calling.
I appreciate that, sir.
You bet.
God bless you, and bye-bye.
You too, bye-bye. Martin Luther made a statement about the monastics. He says, whoever looked at a monk drooled in devotion and had to be ashamed of his secular station in life. Despair, said Luther, makes the monk. It means that either a man has no confidence in his ability to make a living and runs into a monastery for the sake of his stomach, or that he despairs of the world and is not sure of himself that he will remain pious. But we are not made for fleeing human company, but for living in society and sharing good and evil. Nay, the domestic and menial work of a maidservant or manservant is more pleasing to God than all the fastings and works of a monk or priest, because the latter are done without faith.
That's marvelous.
That's excellent.
You know, I grew up hearing testimonies from people who'd abandoned the nightclub scene or sports or entertainment when they became a Christian. And in these testimonies, they say, well, now I sing for the Lord. You know, I used to, and I can't help but tell this story. It was in Rolling Stone magazine, and which disqualifies me right there.
That's a secular publication,
right,
Mike.
And they had this one individual who was from Rolling Stone who went to Heritage USA and went into their bookstore there, and he says, amazing, they must have been working for the other side. Because he said, it was a book and record store. He says, it was a bookstore without any books, a record store without any music. He said, I can't imagine them actually saying this, but he says, song after song that I listened to, and this is a non-Christian, said underneath it all, how I found the Lord and lost my talent. And that is a sad commentary.
That's a sad indictment of the contribution we have made to our culture.
Does that mean when people, great artists, become Christians, they have to now start singing inferior kind of?
Two examples, Bach and Rembrandt.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we could think of a number of Reformation artists.
Let's codify this a little bit with some numbers. In the Christian publishing industry, the statistics show that we sell more records, tapes, books, and Bibles every year, that it grows incrementally. And you turn on any secular media, any media project in the United States, and you see virtually no influence of the Protestant faith. Mm. Now, something is wrong when we sell more of our junk than we've sold the year before, and we make continually less and less and less of an impact on our culture for Jesus Christ. Something is intrinsically wrong.
We think of the cultural impact of the Protestant work ethic. It not only was a biblical doctrine, and a biblical challenge to the believer, giving a sense of purpose and sanctity and dignity to the workaday world. But it also contributed greatly even beyond people's spiritual lives to the whole culture, didn't it?
Yeah, it contributed to all of what we know as the Western civilization.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. One Puritan divine said, that saying, each man for himself and God for us all, is a most devilish saying indeed. The Puritans, for whom sometimes this is called the Puritan work ethic.
Right.
The Puritans were known as people who said, hey, look, the reason God has given us a calling is not so that we can go out and make a lot of money and become ambitious and climb the ladder. The reason God has given us a calling is so that we have something to give to the neighbor in town who needs that.
We become producers rather than consumers.
And it's just the opposite today, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
A credit card society that is more interested in making money to pay off debts than in making money to help the community and to serve a vital interest in the community. The Puritans believed that society was a commonwealth, like a wheel in which every person contributed as a spoke. The butcher needed the farmer needed the merchant, and so on. We really need to get back to this today, don't we?
We really do.
Now, if we did, there would probably be a greater witness to the gospel of Christ than there currently is.
Well, if I take the contemporary films and music seriously, this is something that could be the route in. The despair that comes with the meaninglessness, that nothing that I've done counts, and then I'll die and they'll plant me, is a very deep despair.
So unless you employ your talents for the church or a church-related ministry, your work really is in
forgotten.
Vain.
Right. It's in vain.
And that despair is found in the church equally as well as in the culture.
Yeah, that's a real tragedy. It shouldn't be that way. How about some closing comments, Rod and Kim?
Well, I think this subject tonight is extremely important. I think it is one of the ways in which people can find meaning in their life, and that is to not only to look forward in spiritual things, but to look forward in their day-to-day life in their workplace. That whatever they do, they can do it to the glory of God, whether that be building cabinets or doing plumbing or raising your children. It all can be done to the glory of God, and satisfaction can be found in doing that well for God's glory.
Yeah, and I'd add something that we talked about, both of us, at the beginning of the program. The theological underpinnings for this have to do with God becoming flesh in the person of Jesus Christ. Mm. And that means that, in a way, all of human life, including work, was hallowed by the Incarnation. Not only did he create it from the beginning, but he also came to be a part of it as an individual, which makes everything part of our, quote, normal life, not just mundane.
It's not just normal anymore.
Nope.
You know, earlier I used that illustration of the cathedral, and one worker hewing out rock out of a quarry with sweat on his brow saw it as just work, and the other person saw it as building a cathedral. And I wonder, for our folks out there, are you building a cathedral? Is that how you view your work? Same task as those who think it's just a job, Manic Monday, but you may be building a cathedral that you don't know about. You are occupying the post to which God has called you.
Yeah, it easily could be that you're the one that doesn't know that. You've got to operate with the doctrine of the Incarnation. But there are all kinds of, as Lewis said, there are all kinds of surprises up there ahead.
Our next series will be on the work of Christ as we approach the Easter season, and this being, in fact, the second Sunday in Lent, and we will be discussing the cross of Christ in our next series on the White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.